Okay, welcome everybody to the mystical program of the Kabbalists of Tzfat. I want to do three things with you in the course of the next 50 minutes or so. And those are that I would like to speak for a couple of minutes about some of the main figures that lived in Tzfat in the 16th century. Can I get a quick show of hands? How many people have been to Tzfat? Okay, almost every single person. That's great. How many people have been to Tzfat, you know, more than once? Okay, terrific. So I want to speak briefly about some of the main figures, particularly illuminating some of the aspects that might not have been given to you by the tour guides when you were wandering around. Then I want to talk about some of the practices that were instituted by the Kabbalists of 16th century Tzfat and that were and that are still with us today to give a sense of how influential they are in terms of our Judaism. And lastly, to do probably not a deep study of Lecha Dodi, but Lecha Dodi, of course, was written in Tzfat in the 16th century, and to give you some of the highlights of the mystical details of the song. In the same way that it is often said by the Pshat commentators about the Torah, in other words, those commentaries on the Torah that argue that we need to understand first and foremost the simple meaning of the text, and they say, "Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto," that the Torah never loses its simple sense. That whatever complex interpretative modes you want to and methods you want to use to interpret the Torah, that nonetheless it is always going to retain its simple, plain meaning as well. Well, the inverse probably should be said about Lecha Dodi, that Ein Lecha Dodi Yotze Midei Sodo, that it is really impossible to understand Lecha Dodi without understanding the Kabbalistic meanings, and hopefully we'll be able to see how that's true. So, first of all, the town of Tzfat, which, you know, we may go to today, and we experience both as a kind of a sleepy town and also a tourist town, was a very important place on the trade route during the 16th century. In some ways, it was more important than Yerushalayim was at the time. The Jews had greater freedom in Tzfat than they did in Yerushalayim. There were more tax collectors in Yerushalayim, so the cost of living was higher in Yerushalayim. And there was a great deal more creativity that was going on at that time. After the expulsion from Spain in 1492, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews that made their way across Europe and that ended up landing in different places, really landing all across Europe, in Poland, in Amsterdam, much of Eastern Europe. But many of them made their way to Turkey. The Turkish Sultan, as is well known, invited the Jews to come, far cry, unfortunately, from what's going on today. And many of those Jews, because Turkey is so close to Israel, then made their way across to the Holy Land. The town of Tzfat in the 16th century was one of the most remarkable assembly of mystics, pietists, and halachists anywhere in Jewish history since the destruction of the Second Temple, or perhaps shortly thereafter, after the period of the Tanaim, perhaps, that just a remarkable assortment of folks. Rav Yosef Caro, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Moshe Cordovero, who was the leading Kabbalist in Spain, in Tzfat before the arrival of the Arizal, Rav Yitzhak Luria, of course, Chaim Vital, all of the disciples that went around Isaac Luria, and the Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, who authored the song Lecha Dodi, Eliezer Azikri, who authored the song Yedid Nefesh, just as some of the most well-known of the figures that were living at that time. Let me tell you a little bit about the more hidden aspects of their lives that may not be as familiar with. So the very first one, of course, is Rav Yosef Karo, lives from 1488 to 1575. And he lived, he had two careers, or at least his the first half of his career after he left Spain as a, really as a very young child, was in Turkey. And in Turkey, he wrote the Beit Yosef, his grand halachic work that was a commentary on the Torah. But all the time that he was there, he was longing for three main things. One was to live in Eretz Yisrael, which he managed to do later in life. The second, that his works should be widely disseminated, which they were, and flawless. And while many might dispute or have argued over the centuries over and about the Shulchan Aruch, the power and influence of it, of course, is indisputable. And the last thing that was really a very prominent desire of his was to dial Kiddush Hashem, that there was this deep desire that he had to die as a martyr. And there were examples of martyrs in his day, and he thought, that's the way to go. Okay, most of us, when we think about that time, God willing, it should not come until 120 in good health. Imagine we'd like to just go to sleep, you know, wake up the next morning, genug. But he wanted to go up in flames. Now, how do we know about these deep desires? If you read the Shulchan Aruch, he doesn't talk personally. If you read the Beit Yosef, he doesn't speak personally. But he wrote a mystical diary called Magid Meisharim, which he had never intended for dissemination. It was found after he died. And there he gives a kind of mystical commentary on the Torah, but more importantly, he talks about his nightly interactions with an angel or some kind of divine being, some aspect of divinity itself, perhaps an aspect of Shekhinah. But it was an entity that he called a magid, a teacher or a speaker. And he would write the accounts of what would take place in those nightly interactions. So here you have one of the most extraordinarily sober, legal minds in all of Jewish history, a rigorous thinker who every single night is having an interaction with this angel. How does he get this? How does this angel come? Does it knock at the door? Does it come through the chimney? Does it, you know, come in through the windows? What he would do is he would go engage in a nightly meditative practice of recital of Mishnayot, recital of Mishnah. And in fact, this was a mystical practice that was conducted by many of the Kabbalists in Sfat. Some of them would take one Mishnah and they would repeat it over and over like a mantra. And by saying that term over and over again, it would induce a certain kind of mystical trance that would then transport them and induce a transcendent experience in which an angel or some aspect of divinity would come and speak with them or communicate with them. With Rav Yosef Karo, it would actually speak through his own vocal cords and he would ask a question in his voice, and then a very different voice would respond and give him the answers. When I said many of the Kabbalists did it, they had different kinds of practices. Some would recite one Mishnah over and over again. Some would take a few Mishnayot. Rav Yosef Karo would say many, many Mishnayot. Part of his practice that accompanied this was very strict asceticism. He had very strict restrictions on eating and drinking, eating very, very little during the course of the week, and only allowing himself a little bit more during the week, and very strict moral strictures on himself as well, and constantly castigating himself in the course of his dialogue with this Magid. And he would say, oh, I know that you said that I shouldn't, you know, that I'm sleeping too much. And of course, he was only sleeping for 4 or 5 hours a night, if that. And I know that you said that I shouldn't get distracted during the day, but, you know, mea culpa, I, you know, got distracted at several times, and on and on. As if the Magid, you know, Lahavdil, was saying, well, say, you know, say 7 Hail Marys and then do the following penances, because he would say, do the following, the following kinds of practices, recite the following Mishnayot, do extra amounts of study in order to really debase your ego, to bring it down so that you will be the appropriate foundation for Torah to come into the world. That's Rav Yosef Karo. The next figure I want to speak about for several minutes is Rav Yitzchak Luria. And Rav Yitzchak Luria was called the Arizal. And Ari is an acronym for Ha'Elohi. Ha'Elohi, Rabbi Yitzchak, the divine Rabbi Isaac. It's been rumored that Bette Midler got the name of her album, The Divine Miss M, from the Arizal. That's been proven to be false. But I was involved with some of the research on that particular project. The Arizal was born in Jerusalem in 1534, and in the same way that there are midrashim that describe Moshe Rabbeinu being born and being surrounded by brilliant light, and then subsequently the Baal Shem Tov was born surrounded by brilliant light, so is the Arizal born in a room that was surrounded by brilliant light. He's born in Jerusalem of Italian-German extraction. And for a number of years, he moves down to Egypt, where he gets much of his halachic and Kabbalistic education. And then he goes to Tzfat in 1570. So he's born in 1534, goes to Tzfat in 1570, and dies in 1572. In my last session, I referred to Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, dying at a very young age, at the age of 38, and here too with the Arizal dying at the age of 38, and I expressed the hope that this was not what happens to all people that study Kabbalah before the age of 40, because I started in my early 30s, several decades ago. A little bit more on his background before I talk about what he actually did is that he is said to have been a student of Bezalel Ashkenazi in Egypt. Bezalel Ashkenazi was the composer of the Shita Mekubetzet, which is a grand digest and compendium of discussions of the Talmud, and it is by legend, it is ascribed that the volume on Zvachim, on sacrifices, was written by Isaac Luria. In other words, that the volume of Talmudic discussion dealing with the potentially rebuilding of the temple and re-offering of sacrifices was written by this great Kabbalist that obviously has a certain kind of ascribes to him a certain kind of messianic glow. Whether the legend is true or not, we are not sure. He was also a student of the Radbaz, Rav David Ibn Zimra, who was both a noted halachist and Kabbalist. And then when he arrived in Tzfat in 1570, he studied with Rav Moshe Cordovero, who both had a yeshiva for regular studies and was the leading Kabbalist, studied with him until Ramak, Moshe Cordovero, died in 1571. Now, since almost everybody or everybody here has been to Tzfat, you have a sense of the prominence of the cemetery. The cemetery was prominent even in their day, and it was said that there were many great rabbinic figures that were buried there. And in some senses, there was a way in which it is a city that lived with its dead, that there was a increasingly notions of teachings about dibukim, that is, souls that were not able to be reincarnated, that were not finding their rest in Gan Eden, that would then settle into other people's souls and take them over, vulnerable people who committed one small sin. And that small sin would create a kind of an opening, a fissure in their soul, allowing this dibbuk to penetrate. At the same time, there develops an increasing notion that all of us are Gilgulim, all of us are reincarnations of previous souls. And again, this sense that the dead are with us, that at some point, God willing, a long time from now, we too will join that cycle of the living and the dead and the living and the dead. What's remarkable about the Ari is that within 30 years after his death, a hagiography is already written. A hagiography is a saint's biography. In other words, if you pick up an art scroll biography, that is, art scroll biographies typify what a hagiography is. In other words, they talk about the saintliness of a particular figure. I don't want to talk about art scroll for the moment, but if you want to get a sense of what one looks like, that's where you can take a look. But for a hagiography to be circulating within 30 years means that this man left an enormous footprint in his wake. There was a great deal of controversy about how his teachings were transmitted, but what's significant to know about him as a person is that he was a visionary who not only lived with a sense of the dead and the living, but also with the life that permeates, that pervades all of reality, the souls that were embedded in various animals and insects and trees and rocks. There's one story that's told that he and his disciples were sitting under a tree and they were studying Torah. And all of a sudden, some large birds of prey came and were making a terrific noise on the next tree. And they tried to shoo them away, and they wouldn't shoo them away. And in the end, the Arizal himself went over to those birds, and he spoke to them, and they flew away. And what happened is that these were the followers of Korach, the rebels in the desert that had been reincarnated into these birds, and they were trying to glean a little bit of Torah. They were trying to do tshuva and come a little bit closer. And the Arizal said, "Get out of here. Go back to where you belong." Now, if most of us were to do that, if I were to walk among you and, you know, start talking to the bottles of water on the table or to your purses or to, you know, some spider that might be crawling on the ground, you would call Rabbi Kelman or you would call Dr. Malamet and you would say, "We're sorry, but we think that your speaker has lost it." And I would be taken to one of the local hospitals, to the Clark Institute, and checked in, and they would run a series of tests. Why wasn't that done for Rav Yitzchak Luria, brilliant man surrounded by other brilliant critical thinkers? Is that it was believable. It was credible. Is they lived in a culture in which these kinds of things were deemed to be possible. And he seemed to be doing it. He actually seemed to resonate with superhuman powers. He could look you in the face, look at your forehead, tell you of whom you were a reincarnation. He could tell you which mitzvot you had committed, which transgressions you had performed, and he could tell you which particular mitzvah your soul was circulating for in this time, in this particular cycle that you were supposed to be working on rectifying. He did he did various kinds of physiognomy, in other words, analysis of the face to tell people about their backgrounds, their spiritual backgrounds. He was able to read palms, and he also gained knowledge through various kinds of dream visions. Now, if you were to come to my home and look at the books that have on their spine, Kol Kitvei HaArizal, all of the writings of the Arizal, well, they take up about this much space on the bookshelf. And how long again was he in spot? 2.5 years? 2 years and 9 months? Hello? Something's wrong with this equation. And in fact, all that we have of his actual writings are a very short commentary on the first page of the Zohar. It's about a page and a half long, and 3 songs. No other writings that we have that are actually ascribed to his hand. So what does it mean, Kol Kitvei HaArizal? These are all of the writings that his students, that were compiled by his primary disciple, Rav Chaim Vital, and that he had collected from the other students. But even so, I mean, that many volumes in 2.5 years? So here's the trick, is that for 20 years after he died, he used to visit Rav Chaim Vital, and he would teach him. So over the course of 20 years, yeah, you can write that many books. But it's only because of those nightly visits that Rav Chaim Vital tells us about that we have all of those teachings. The next figure I want to mention is, very briefly, Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, who is the author of Lecha Dzodi, but who also wrote other Kabbalistic works. And it is he that testifies, that witnessed the interaction between Rav Yosef Karo and his Magid. That he says, I saw it, here is what happened. So to the extent that, you know, we're willing to rely on that kind of first person witnessing, sounds like there was some kind of remarkable phenomenon that went on for Rav Yosef Karo on a regular basis. The last person I want to mention is Israel Moshe Cordovero, who wrote a voluminous commentary on the Zohar. If you were to read Gershom Scholem on the 16th century Kabbalists, he describes Moshe Cordovero as an encyclopedist, because he wrote a very important work called Pardes Rimonim. It's about that thick, very dense work. It summarizes all of the Kabbalah until that day. But what Scholem was not familiar with was the commentary on the Zohar, in which it emerges that Moshe Cordovero himself had a very rich mystical life, having various kinds of mystical and spiritual experiences. Let's now switch gears and talk about some of the practical activities that were instituted by these Kabbalists and that continue with us to this day. How many people here daven with a Nusach Sfard Sidur? The truth is that it could well be that many of you are also davening with a Nusach Sfard Sidur. When I grew up in Toronto, most of the Orthodox shuls in Toronto were davening Nusach Sfard, because most of the Jews in Toronto came from Eastern Europe at that time, and that's what they davened with. More modern Orthodox shuls, as they started to grow here in the city, adopted Nusach Ashkenaz, which was a more Western kind of version of the liturgy. But the Nusach Sfard was developed by the Arizal, and even though he was an Ashkenazi, of Ashkenazi extract, he imported a whole series of Kabbalistic and Sephardic innovations that were part of the Sephardi rite. And so that's why, even though many or most of us may come from Eastern Europe and are Ashkenazi, we are davening from this strange hybrid of Ashkenazi and Sephardi liturgy. When we are counting Sfirat HaOmer, there's something that we say before the Sfira, a prayer that is in many, many prayer books. It's standard. And the truth is that if you were to look at a Hasidic prayer book, or in a Sephardic prayer book, you would find the same kind of prayer or petition before many of the mitzvot and many of the prayers. It's called L'shem Yichud, is how it's commonly referred to, for the sake of unification. There are a series of versions of L'shem Yichud. The one that I say every day before Pesukei Dezimra is L'shem Yichud Kutshabrichu Shkintei B'tchilu Orchimu Orchimu T'chilu L'yachad Hashem Yudhei B'vavhei B'yichud Ishlim B'shem Ko Yisrael, which means, for the sake of the unification of the Blessed Holy One and His Shekhinah, in fear and in love, and in love and in fear, for the sake of the unification of the name Yud and He with Vav and He. In other words, that the way in which we are commonly experiencing divinity is in a somewhat fractured state, and we want to feel that the tetragrammaton, the Yud and He and Vav and He, which connotes the entire mystery of God in God's full united sense, in a full unity, in the name of all of Israel. Meaning that it's not just for my sake that this should be done, but for the sake of all of us, or rather that on account of the righteousness of all of us, of our corporate identity, that unification should take place. What we're seeing with the institution of that kind of practice is a prayer before a prayer. In other words, it's the sense that you have to have kavanah. You have to have proper kind of spiritual intention for your prayer. Most of the time, we're not getting it. So what we need to do is we need to sort of prime the engine. Before I start my lawnmower, I got to press a little red button 3 times. I don't know what that does. That's the magic. You press it 3 times, and then you can pull on the gas. And the idea being that if we prime ourselves in that way, then we'll be able to have the right kind of kavanah or mystical intention as we go forward. One of the ironic things that happens in the course of the history of Jewish prayer in Jewish prayer books is that these things multiply. Is that, you know, first you have, you know, we have the prayers that were set for us by Chazal, by the rabbis of the Talmud. And then at a certain point, people felt, well, you know, we need something to sort of rev us up before that. So we say some songs, Psukei Dezimra. And then there's a sense, well, you know, we don't really have the right intention for that. We're going to have to rev ourselves up a little bit. So we have to say Elishem Yichud Kuchabrichu Rishchinte before that. And then you get a piling on of a prayer before a prayer before a prayer until at a certain point, what we are doing is we are spending close to half of our time doing prayers before prayers instead of the prayer itself. So going back again to Sefirat HaOmer, that's one of the prominent places in which we see that particular prayer. But there's another part that's very prominent in most prayer books, is that we have this reference to the Sefirot. And we have a countdown that takes place of those 49 days. And I can't go into the technical details of it because it would take too long. But we are moving through a series of 49 stages of divinity becoming lower and lower into this world. As it were, bringing the Torah closer and closer until the 50th day, which of course is Shavuot, is the day in which we receive that manifestation of holiness, of divinity. And so that's why on the very first day we talk about Chesed, Sheba Chesed. On the second day it's Gvura, Sheba Chesed, then Tiferet, Sheba Chesed. We move through a series of 7 Sefirot with 7 rungs in each one of those Sefirot until we get through 49 stages. The recital of Yedid Nefesh on Friday afternoon comes from the Kabbalists. The singing of Eshet Chayil on Friday nights comes from the Kabbalists. When we sing Eshet Chayil on Friday night, and I hope that none of you will tell Franny that this is available on the web. Franny's my wife. But when the Kabbalists instituted this, they said, you're singing this for the sake of the Shekhinah. You're not singing this for your wife, regardless of how holy she is, how elevated she is. We are singing this for the feminine presence of divinity that is most manifest on Friday night. Now, the truth is that I used to say this on a regular basis on Friday nights in my home. And after many weeks in the doghouse, I finally smartened up and said, yes, dear, of course, we are singing this for you. Many people may be familiar with the song Atkinu Sudata, that precedes each one of the 3 Sabbath meals, but most people are familiar with it before the 3rd meal. That is a formula that originates in the Zohar, but was made part of the 3 songs that Rav Yitzchak Luria wrote for Shabbat. The fast of the firstborn, which is widely practiced, is instituted at that time. The recitation of Zohar, particularly on Friday nights, but among some on a regular basis. This occurs in Sephardi communities, particularly in Moroccan communities, where very often after the meal they would read through Zohar, and this would be regardless of whether they were understanding it or not. And my hunch is because this was such a popular practice that most people were probably not understanding it, but there was a sense of engagement with holiness occurring at that time. The emphasis on wearing 2 sets of tefillin, even though there's a medieval argument about, and possibly an ancient argument about whether you should be wearing tefillin that are arranged in one way or another. They're called, the tefillin of Rashi and the tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. It was the Kabbalists of the 16th century that said, you know what, better be safe. And wear both of them, you're sure to be yotzei. The recital of Brich Shmei, there's a particular passage of Zohar that is recited almost universally in Orthodox synagogues, and I would guess in conservative synagogues as well. This is a passage of Zohar that was instituted to be recited at this time by the Kabbalists in Sfat. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that in the earliest Zohar manuscripts, that passage is not there. Okay, that this seems to be added on maybe in the 14th century, maybe in the 15th century, at some later stage of the development of the Zohar. The what else? There are night vigils. We stay up all night on Shavuot. Some people stay up all night on Hoshana Rabbah studying Torah. These were instituted by the 16th century Kabbalists. Erev Rosh Chodesh as a Day of Atonement, which is not so widely practiced, but is practiced to a certain extent, was instituted by these Kabbalists. Certain kinds of weeping practices were instituted by them, praying at grave sites, recitation of Mishnayot. When a person passes away, very often, it's very common that people recite Mishnayot in that person's memory. My own father died 4 months ago, Zichrono Livracha, and Eish Torah and various other people are learning the entire Mishnah in his memory. There were practices of receiving lashes on Erev Yom Kippur. This goes back to the early 80s. Early 90s. I lived in New York above the shtiebel of Rabbi Vorhands, who was the chief rabbi of Prague after the war. So I lived in a building that had a shtiebel on the main floor. We had a men's mikveh in the basement. We had a sukkah in the back. It was I hardly had to leave the building. But there was one Erev Yom Kippur that I was walking back to my apartment, and there was an elderly man there who was a survivor who saw me coming, and he's standing outside the building. He starts taking his belt off. I think, okay, well, this is a little weird. He said, will you give me malkot? Will you give me lashes? And I said, okay. And so we stepped into the Beis Medrash, into the shtiebel, and he got down on all fours. And so at that point, I think, early 30s, and here's a man who is probably in his 70s, and he's on all fours, and he gives me his belt. And I was able to convince the police that he had died of natural causes, but... No, what gets done is a series of symbolic lashes in which one taps the person 39 times, which is the maximum number of lashes that were administered by the rabbis, as one recites Vehu, Rachum, Yechaper, Avon, etc., a verse that consists of 13 verses. So we went through the verse 13 three times, times 13. 13 words is 39 lashes. And finally, something that is still practiced today, mostly in Hasidic circles as well as Kabbalistic circles, is Tikkun Chatzot, to get up in the middle of the night and to wail for the destruction of the temple, to pray for its being rebuilt. With the remaining time, let me stop here and just ask, are there any questions up to this point? And I'll take a few, and then I'll take more once we go through the Chatzot. Yeah. So the truth is that there is a certain amount of opposition. There's particularly opposition. There's a big battle about the publication of the Zohar that takes place right at this time. And part of that is not because there was opposition to the Zohar per se, though there was a little bit, but mostly about whether these kinds of things should be widely practiced. So, yes, there was some opposition, but the figures that were involved here were such heavyweights that, and the Kabbalistic theology and Kabbalistic practices were given such credence through most of the Jewish world at that time, most of the Jewish world, that they were widely accepted. When you get to the time of the Vilna Gaon, he refused to insert any kinds of practices, any rituals or ritual changes post-Chazal, or at least what he understood to be post-Chazal. He, of course, thought that the Zohar was a rabbinic work, so he could imagine internalizing some of those. It's an important question. One or two more questions then before we go to L'chad Odi. Yeah.
You mentioned that the way they disseminated their teachings
was controversial. Could you explain what you meant by that? So the question was that I had said that the dissemination of teachings was controversial. Just now?
No, before, earlier, you said that the way that the mystics disseminated their teachings was in a controversial way, but you didn't elaborate on what you meant by that.
Okay, so I'm going to have to recite some Mishnayot very quickly in order to have my Magid come down to speak through my vocal cords and supply that answer. What I think I may have been referring to is that there's a certain amount of controversy about how the teachings of the Arizal were transmitted. Rav Chaim Vital was very strict about who could be in the Arizal's group and who couldn't be, and he would chase people out of the group and tell the Arizal, well, you can let this one in, let that one in, and he went through editing process after editing process, and he would say, this is authentic stuff and this is inauthentic stuff. I don't want to say, God forbid, that Chaim Vital was a control freak, but he certainly was very controlling of how this stuff went, was disseminated. And there's an important Kabbalist from that time, Yisrael Sarug, who claims to have been a student of Rav Yitzchak Luria, who Rav Chaim Vital deemed to be inauthentic, and yet increasingly there's reason to believe that he probably was. Perhaps it was in Egypt before the Arizal came up. But the truth is that there was a certain kind of, within a short period of time, these teachings became accessible. However, they are extraordinarily technical and extraordinarily difficult and paradoxical. And so for me, in my own study of Kabbalah, I tend to focus on the earlier Kabbalah, where there are 10 balls that I have to keep up in the air, 10 spherot, or at most 10 that are in 10, 100 balls. Once you start reading Lurianic Kabbalah, there are spherot within spherot that are in worlds that are within Partsufim. It's extremely difficult to follow. Let's now shift gears, take a quick look at L'chad Zodi, so that hopefully you will never sing L'chad Zodi the same again. I hope that you are all either accountants or related to accountants. It's certainly my own heritage that led me to what I'm about to instruct you to do. I want you to take a look at the very first line. That's familiar, I presume, to everybody in the room. I want you to count the letters. First one to give me a count wins a prize. Oh, 26 letters. Now, what's the significance of the number 26? It is the numerical equivalent of the tetragrammaton, of the most the ineffable name of God, the Yud, which equals 10, the He, which equals 5, Yud, which equals 10, and Vav, Yud, He, and then Vav, and then Vav equals 6, and then the He equals equals another 5. You get a total of 26. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to look down the page and see how many times is L'chad Zodi, that refrain, sung as a refrain. In other words, omit the first line, but every time that you see it without vocalizations, where it just says L'chad Zodi. How many times are we saying it?
Ten.
10 times. Ding, ding, ding. Prize to the lady over there in the blue sweater and the navy blue sweater. What I would like to suggest, why is it 10 times, corresponding to each one of the 10 sfirot? 10 sfirot, and this is about as Kabbalistic as we'll get, refers to the 10 rungs of divinity, are the 10 manifestations, the 10 features through which God manifests divinity in the world. So that in the same way, that I am son and father and brother and husband and friends and teacher and stranger, there are similar features, similar ways in which God is also manifest in various ways, some that more people are exposed to, that are more accessible, and some that are less accessible. So the idea being then of reciting that 26 10 times, what would be the meaning of that? It is as if we are expressing the very essence of divinity through the very essence of divinity. In other words, the 26, every time we sing L'chad Zodi, it is as if we are saying the name Yud, He, Vav, and He, as if we are saying the ineffable name of God. We recite it 10 times so that the entirety of divinity, all of those rungs, are all being manifest every time that we sing the entirety of L'chad Zodi. Now, I want to show you one more thing. I want you to go back to counting in that first line, and count the letters before the period and then the letters after the period. How many before the period? 15. How would you write the number 15 using Hebrew letters? Yud and He. And then Pnei Shabbat Nekabla, how many letters are there?
11.
Now, usually we would write 11 as Yud Aleph, but you could also write it as Vav and He. Okay? So that you see how carefully composed that first line is. Okay? This is not just about welcoming the Sabbath bride, or rather, the Sabbath bride that we are welcoming is divinity itself. Now, the next question that we need to ask is, who are we? And who is the Kala? And who is the Dod? We clearly are the Jews. The Dod, who is the Dod here, the beloved that we are saying, let us welcome together the bride? It's a sham, but it's a sham in a very particular sense. It is the Kodesh Baruch Hu, who is the masculine aspect of divinity, and we call on him as, and remember these were male Kabbalists writing for male Kabbalists, calling on the male Kabbalists to invite the Shabbos bride. That there is a way in which this spiritual experience that the Kabbalists are invoking is an erotic or eroticized experience. And by that I don't mean something pornographic, God forbid, but rather something that is the very height of intimacy, the deepest sense of lovingness. If we go through this song, we will see that it is working on a number of different levels. That this bride that we are greeting, the Shekhinah, can also be referring, this feminine presence might also be our own souls, Jerusalem, the temple, and the people of Israel as a whole. And if you go through the whole song, you can plant each one of those meanings into the verses, and they would fit. That when we talk about hitorari, hitorari, of wake up, wake up, we're talking to our own souls and saying, wake up. You know, it's been a hard week. We've been working. We've been slogging away, doing whatever we're doing. And you finally get to chill out. It's Shabbat. Wake up. Free yourself. Put on a new garment, right? It says, shake off this dusty garment that you're wearing. What is the dust? It's the dust that Yerushalayim is wearing, that the Temple Mount is wearing under the rule of the Ottomans, and a longing for a revival, not just of my soul, not just for the spiritual experience of Shekhinah coming into our presence, but even for Yerushalayim itself to be rebuilt, for the Temple to be rebuilt, so that, as I was saying in my previous session about Rabbi Nachman, that we're seeing both eschatological levels operating at the same time, both the redemption of the soul and the redemption of the whole Jewish people, and both of them are interacting one with each other. That there's one is interpreted in the light of the other, and one is will cause the advent of the other. With the I'll take one more minute to take a look at the first stanza, and then we'll stop for a couple of minutes of questions. The very first words of the first stanza say, Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. Now, this is a statement that we're familiar with from Chazal. Why do Chazal say this? What does it mean? Is guard the Sabbath day and remember the Sabbath day? B'dibur echad. They were said in one word. Okay. So what she said is that there are two different versions of the Ten Commandments, one in Sefer Shemot, one in Sefer Dvarim. One says, Shamor et Yom HaShabbat. The other one says, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat. And Chazal, who didn't have recourse to biblical criticism, which is sort of an easy way out, and said, oh, well, J said it this way, and E said it that way. What Chazal did when they came across these bumps is they created meaning. And what they said is that it was a miracle, is that both of them were said at precisely the same moment. But the Kabbalists ramp it up. They raise it to a higher level. And what they say is, Shamor v'zachor are referring to two different kinds of commandments, two different types. Two negative commandments, the lo ta'aseis, and positive commandments, the aseis. Shamor, referring to the lo ta'aseis, the don't do this, and zachor, the ones that one has to do. And they say yet further that those are referring to the feminine and masculine aspects of divinity. So in other words, what took place at Mount Sinai, which we commonly understand as the wedding of God and the Jewish people, was actually, for the Kabbalists, the marriage of Kutchubrichu Ushkinteh, of the masculine aspect of divinity and the feminine aspect of divinity. And what is occurring at that moment, at that fusion, that merging of positive commandments and negative commandments. In other words, that the giving of the Torah, the giving of the mitzvah of Shabbat, what occurs on a weekly basis, is the reunification of that which has been rent, that which has been ripped apart over the course of the week. That there is a harmony that is supposed to settle in on Shabbat, that is not just what we experience at home or what we experience in shul, but rather through the entire cosmos and through divinity itself. We have time for a couple of questions. Back here. And okay, so the question that was asked is, who wrote the Zohar and when was it written? That's a really great question, and I gave a talk for Torah in Motion about a year ago on it, but it would take at least, to do it justice, would take at least 10 minutes, and I'd be happy to talk to you as soon as we're done. Yeah, back here. Well, I wouldn't want to say that God's own self is divided, but certainly the way in which the Kabbalists describe it, following in the footsteps of Chazal, who talk about Midat Rachamim and Midat Hadin, that there are ways in which God manifests God's self differently in the world. And in the Gemara, it talks about how what the prayers of the righteous do is they move God from the seat of Midat Hadin, of the attribute of judgment, to the seat of Midat HaRachamim. Similarly, what the Kabbalists do is they just give different names. Is they talk about how there's a masculine aspect and a feminine aspect. But in many ways, all they're doing is giving a vast theological development and ritual expression to that same basic notion. Look, perhaps the easiest way to address the question is on Yom Kippur. Just a couple months ago, we chant Hashem Hashem Kel Rachum V'Chanun Erech Apayim V'Rav Chesed, right? Yud Gimel Midot Rachmim, 13 attributes of mercy. Now, 13. On the other hand, we're supposed to, our last words, and our words when we wake up and when we go to sleep, are what? Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. God is one. Sounds like a contradiction. But it's not a contradiction. Here's the last counting I'm going to ask you to do, and then I think that we will have to stop, and I'm happy to talk with folks afterwards. is imagine the word, oh, here, you've got it on your page. Okay, in Shamor v'Zachor b'Dibur Echad, take a look at the word Echad. I want you to tell me the gematria of the word Echad. Aleph equals what? One. Chet equals what?
Eight.
Dalet equals what?
Four.
1 plus 8 plus 4 equals 13. So there you have it. Is that even, now here I am being cute, but there's a, but, thanks, Shirley. But there is a way in which the Kabbalists understand this to be actually a manifestation, an expression, a teaching of the mystery of God. And part of the, I think part of the problem that the Kabbalists had with Maimonidean teaching about the, and Maimonides, of course, was drawing on Aristotelian teaching before him and Neoplatonic teaching before him, on the philosophically pure unity, the simple unity of God, for the Kabbalists, was just not Jewish. Is that that's not what the Torah teaches. And what the Kabbalists wanted to do is they wanted to get us back on the right footing again. Baruch Hashem. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take questions after the after.